In America, our tradition is a little simpler. Our tradition is that we take our checks and we write the date and we scratch out the 14 and put 15 over it for about a week. And so this is the first full week of 2015. This is the week we're all going to be saying, wow, I can't believe it's 2015 over and over again. This is the week we're going to be scratching out the date and trying to figure it out. So this is the first full week of 2015. Today is also the Sunday that we celebrate Epiphany, which is a day that is actually the 6th of January. The 6th of January signifies the end of the Christmas season, and it is Epiphany. It is the day that we use to remember and celebrate the Magi coming to worship Jesus, among the very first people in the universe to worship the newborn king. And the Magi came not on Christmas night, as many of your manger scenes and pictures and things will show. They came sometime later, right? The scripture tells us that they came to the house and they found Mary and Joseph inside and we're no longer in the manger. We're no longer in the storage area. We're no longer in the garage or the tool shed. We're in the house now, and we've gotten a little bit bigger, and these Magi make it to the house and they meet Mary and Joseph and they introduce them to the Christ child. Another thing that we hear that isn't necessarily accurate is the number of Magi. Look at your Bible, any translation you want, you're not going to find any one of them that says there were three Magi. You're going to find them that says there were Magi, and they offered gifts of frankincense, gold, and myrrh. It doesn't even say three gifts or this many of each gift. The reality is that Magi usually traveled in caravans of dozens of individuals. And really, when we talk about three kings, even the hymn that we sang, we talk about three kings, sometimes we miss how cool that would have looked for this caravan of camels and carts and wagons and individuals, all well-dressed, showing up at this little house in the town of Bethlehem to a poor family to offer them gifts and worship the king. We don't know how many there were. I guess it could have been three. It'd just be a coincidence if that was true, though. We just know that there were three examples of the gifts that they offered, and we don't even know how much of each of those gifts they gave. But the Magi are important. A lot of times, the story of the Magi is one of those stories that ends up put up on the shelf. So we come to Christmas, and we have all these awesome stories, and we recall the Christmas story, and maybe we do it as a family, or we come to church, and we hear it, and we read those scriptures, and it's just so cool. We love to hear the stories. We love to think in our mind, what might that have looked like? And then Christmas is over and we put it up on a shelf. You know, it's funny, when it comes to the retail world, as long as they make money, they'll keep something going, right? So they'll start Christmas as early as they can. It'll be, you know, by next year, it'll be July 10th and they'll start putting the Christmas decorations out, right? But December 26th, when nobody's buying Christmas stuff anymore, boom, we're done, right? All of a sudden, it's over. But in the church, Christmas starts on the 25th. That's not when it ends. And Christmas lasts for 12 more days. And the Magi are an important part of Christmas that sometimes get cut off when we ignore Epiphany and when we stop Christmas on the 25th. The Magi are very important to the Christian faith. Now, probably few of you, if any of you, have ever had an experience where you said, wow, after reading that story of the Magi, my heart was really warmed and I felt really close to God. Probably not, because it's not one of those flashy, exciting stories, at least not after you've heard it over and over again for every year of your life. But it's a very important story. Because the Magi and coming to Christ symbolize the most important reality of who Christ is. The Magi coming to Christ symbolize the whole meaning of the gospel. The Magi aren't the crucifixion. The Magi aren't even the birth story. But they are incredibly, incredibly important to the narrative of the gospel. The Magi symbolize why God came. We're sinful people, and unfortunately that's just a reality we live with. We live in a world that is polarized. We live in a world that has, you know, rejected doing the things that we're supposed to do. And we as individuals, try as we might and as hard as we work towards being better and better people, we still from time to time sin. We still from time to time do things that harm ourselves, others, and God. And even so, God offers this extraordinary forgiveness. We know that's the gospel. That's the essence of why we're here and why we believe. But these Magi were individuals who God sent to worship Christ. These Magi were not of God's religion. They were not Jews. They might have been semi-Jewish. There's some evidence out there to suggest that maybe some of them were Jews or maybe all of them, but there's also evidence to suggest that they were star worshipers. And either way, they were definitely astronomers and astrologers. Their job was to look at the stars. And so these were not the Levite priests, right? These were not the highest level spiritual authority in the kingdom. These were not the kings, the rulers. These were not the Pharisees, the lawyers, the people who studied and understood the scriptures. These were the kings, the magi. These were the wealthy people who came along with the poor people, the shepherds, and they came together to worship the Christ child, each in their own way, because they came to symbolize that God came for everyone. A lot of times we fixate on God coming to the poor folks, and that's because most of us can much better associate ourselves with a shepherd than we can a wealthy magi. But God came for everyone, and that's the beauty of the magi coming. It's that God came himself. See, we had the Levite priest. We had a way to talk to God, right? If you were a Levite priest, you could talk to God. And if you found favor with your local priest, you could use them to talk to God. And we had an altar in Jerusalem. We could have made burnt offerings to God in hopes of maybe saving our soul. But God decided that even though we, you and I, and our ancestors were unworthy of being in his presence, he was going to be a part of our world anyway. And so we sent his son, and God himself came to earth. Jesus, as we understand the triune God, was more than just Jesus, more than even just the Messiah. Jesus was God incarnate in the flesh. So here was God in the flesh having come down to earth to be here, to be worshipped by shepherds and magi alike, by two classes that would never associate with one another, by the shepherds who would come early and be there and ready when the child was born, and the magi who would come later and whose faithfulness in the newborn king would lead them to defy their very king that made them wealthy. This extraordinary story is as important to the faith as any other story in the Bible, because it's a common reminder that God came for us to be a presence with us. Now, we're beginning a new sermon series called Resolve, and we make lots of resolutions this time of year. My email inbox especially, I don't know about you, but mine is full of deals for fitness equipment and supplements and everything else, right? This time of year especially, you know, treadmills and snake oil stuff and, you know, water bottles, anything you think of, fitness-related, has been flooding my inbox and Groupon and different ads and things. And I've even gotten ads in the mailbox for gyms and things like that, because it's the new year, right? What's everybody's New Year's resolution? To get healthy, right? And so these companies are ready to make money, and they're ready to take advantage of it, and they're thinking, well, it's only going to last a month, but hey, as long as they spend some money. In fact, I read the other day that most gyms, most big major commercial gyms, rely on only a small portion of their members actually showing up. So they anticipate buying a year in January, and then they never see you after February. In fact, Craigslist is probably by about February, March, going to be flooded with brand new unused treadmills, right? So that's our New Year's resolutions, and a lot of times we don't take them as seriously as we ought to. I got a phone call this last week. I got a lot of phone calls, but this one's always special because it's from a young man who's very, very friendly and is always a good friend. So I got a phone call from Drew, most of you know. And Drew calls me. He says, "Pastor John, what's your New Year's resolution?" And I said, "Well, I'm not really sure. I hadn't thought about it too much." And he said, "Well, mine is to go bowling once a month." So I thought, well, that's pretty good. I like that New Year's resolution. That's attainable. That's something you can really do. You enjoy. But, you know, I thought about it a little bit, and I'm not usually one to make New Year's resolutions, just because I kind of hold the attitude that if there's something you want to do, if there's something you want to change, if there's something you want to get better at, then you need to do it or change it or get better at it. You don't need to wait till the beginning of the year to have some sort of epiphany, no pun intended, with Epiphany Sunday. You need to have some sort of epiphany to change it. If you're ready to make a change in your life, or if you're ready to become better at something or become stronger or in whatever way change something, then the best time to do that is the moment that you realize that, hey, I'm ready to do this, not January 1st. January 1st is as arbitrary as anything else. But I did think about it, and I thought about what my New Year's resolutions were going to be. And I had already kind of worked on this series a little bit and kind of conceptualized it. And I realized that my New Year's resolutions were not really New Year's resolutions, but what I was going to do in 2015, maybe a better way to put it, was in two parts. One was physical and one was spiritual. On the physical side, I'm continuing to improve myself as I have been for the last year or so. most of you have only known me since July, so you didn't know me a year before that when I weighed about 100 pounds more than I did in July when I came here. But continuing on that path has kind of been a big part for me of 2015 and including getting physically fit. So I lost enough weight now that my doctor doesn't freak out if I run and, you know, destroy my knees and stuff. So I've been running and realizing that my mantra of only run when you're being chased and only fast enough to avoid capture is still true. I mean, it works. It's effective. But it's still not all that much fun. But But even so, you know, getting better physically active. But the other is spiritual. The other is significantly more important than a body that's temporary. The other is spiritual, and that's becoming more intentional. Becoming more intentional in the things that I do and preaching intentionality. Something I kind of started at the end of last year, but becoming more on purpose with the things that I do spiritually and with the things that I encourage you to do. And so with that in mind, we're beginning this series. And over the next 6 weeks, so we're going to take 1 week off, and I'm going to be gone on the 18th, and Joyce is going to be preaching, and but we will return to the series after that, and we're going to be talking about what our New Year's resolutions as a church are going to be, what we're going to do as a church to become more intentional. And this is not just going to be a six-week series. So I'm going to preach about it for 6 weeks, right? So you're going to hear six sermons after this week on this topic, but we're going to revisit these ideas all throughout the year at various times. We're going to revisit them on Sunday morning. We're going to revisit them in special worship services. We're going to revisit them at ad council meetings. This is going to be a year-long thing because I really believe that when it comes to the church, we can be solutions, right? We can be silly about, I'm going to lose weight this year, and by January 3, forget about that. But when we're going to make a resolution as a church, and we tell God, hey, God, we're going to do some things differently this year, we need to really stick to it, don't we? So we're going to really be connecting church over the next year to do these things, to do these five things that we know help churches be as healthy as they can be. And this is based on our bishop, Bishop Snasey's book, Five Practices of Fruitful Congregations. A number of you have already read that book or have done it as a study here in the church. But we're going to look at it at a slightly different angle, more individually rather than the aspect of leadership in the church. Those five practices are, I don't know if you can read them, it's a little lighter on this. I never know when I look at my screen how it's going to show up on this one. But the five practices are radical hospitality, passionate worship, intentional faith development, risk-taking mission and service, and extravagant generosity. Now, if you think about what those sound like on the outside, some of them are going to make a lot of sense to you. Some of them are going to seem like, wow, we really do that really well. Some of them are going to sound like, gee, that's not something we do well at all. And that's the great thing about evaluating ourselves as Christians, both as individuals and as a church. We evaluate our strengths, and we make our strengths better, and we evaluate our weaknesses better. We can't get stronger if we glance past weaknesses and only build on our strengths. And at the same time, we're totally ineffective if we build up our weaknesses and ignore what we're good at. Part of this kind of becoming more fit means understanding how the body works for me. And what we realize is that when you're talking about becoming healthier and losing weight and building muscle, you have to stress your body. That's the only way to do it. If simple activity made us bodybuilders, you know, then we could walk around the grocery store and have the biggest legs in town, right? You have to stress yourself. You have to push yourself beyond your comfort zone. It has to be uncomfortable. That's just a reality of what it is. And some people love it and are into that, and I don't understand those people, and I'm worried that some of them need to have their head checked. But my little brother, for example, runs several miles every day, and he just thinks it's the coolest thing in the world, and I don't know what's going on with him. But We know that for our muscles to build, for example, you have to tear them down first. Not injure them, not so much, not push them so hard that they become damaged, but tiny little microscopic tears that you can only see with a microscope that damage tissue in just little bitty spots here and there. And then our bodies, which God has designed to have this incredible ability to heal, will come in and put new tissue where the old tissue has been damaged. And that new tissue is just a little bit stronger than the old tissue. I believe that the Christian spiritual life works the same way. I believe when we look at the scriptures, we see people who pushed their faith to the edge, not too far to injure themselves, not too far to become burnt out or incapable, but just enough to become stronger and to become more effective, taking what they're already strong at and making it stronger, and identifying weaknesses and intentionally, on purpose and with purpose, finding ways to make those weaknesses into strengths. We see it all throughout the scriptures. Both Peter and Paul, for example, struggled with their faith. Two extraordinary people of faith, right? Peter, the disciple with Jesus, right? One of Jesus' apostles. Paul, hello, he wrote half the Bible, for crying out loud. I mean, not literally half, but probably the half that we read the most. We probably spend as much time talking about Paul's letters and epistles as we do any other part of the New Testament. And Paul struggled with his faith. After becoming a Christian, he struggled with what it meant to be a follower of Christ. And in fact, he liked to use the metaphor of the runner quite often. He liked to use the metaphor of the runner winning the race and getting a crown at the end. But the one who runs and wins the race with Jesus gets something so much more than a crown. And Paul understood what it was to struggle with faith, and I think we as Christians should understand that. And I'm not talking about struggling with identity or anything like that. Those are struggles that we're all going to deal with in life. But I'm talking about not being okay with where we are today, because we can always be a little bit stronger. Not being okay with not being better today than we were yesterday, when we decide that it's not okay to just do the same thing and just go through the motions and just be the same each and every day, then suddenly we have to decide to grow and we have to decide to become stronger and become better. And our spiritual lives, I think, really work like that. And that's my prayer for us as we go into these next several weeks. There's a few things I think that we're going to need to do, though. For starters, as we break these sermons down, we're going to need to be here, right? So here's the pastor telling you to be in church, right? So no surprises there. But really, seriously, if we're going to commit to this as a church, to these practices, to doing these things that are going to help us be who God can knows we can be, it means that we're going to have to be here in worship, to worship God and to connect with this and also participate wherever we can. You know, and we're not doing this because we're in trouble. We're not doing this because we're a sinking ship. Sometimes when we talk about growth and change, it's because something bad has happened and you have to fix it. But I think that's totally the wrong attitude to have. I think the reality is that we can do our best work when we take a church like this that loves God, that has an understanding of missions that is awe-inspiring, and that is doing great things for God every day. I think when you take a church like this and you tell a church like this it's time to move forward, I think you can only do incredible things. Because the most dangerous thing we can do, perhaps even more dangerous than becoming in a situation where we have to say, hey, we have to fix something because we're broken, I think the most important thing we can do is to say, you know what, we're doing pretty good, let's get better. We're doing pretty good, let's get even better than we were before. I believe that the Christian life means, and I've said this before, means being better today than we were yesterday and are aiming to be better tomorrow than we were today. That's what the Christian life is all about, becoming better and stronger as Christians. So what does that look like? Well, I think first off, like I said, I think it takes a serious look at things, being intentional, doing things on purpose. I found in my own life, and you probably have too in some instances, that if you don't do things on purpose, if you don't sit down and put your mind to it and do it with purpose, it's probably going to... Very few people are capable of saying, I'm going to do something, and then it just happens, and they don't have to do any work. If you have a big project, or a little project, if you decide, hey, the dishes are piling up, and I need to do dishes, or if you decide, hey, I need to learn to do a new skill, or improve myself in some extraordinary, profound way, you've got to put your mind to it. You've got to say, this is what I'm going to do today to reach my goal, and tomorrow this is what I'm going to do to reach my goal. Bowling, that means once a month he's going to have to bowl, and he's going to have to evaluate his goal, and he's going to have to say, hey, it's 3 weeks into January, and I haven't bowled yet. Sometime next week, I need to bowl. Whatever your goal is, whatever our goals are, we need to measure them, and we need to constantly and intentionally work towards them. So I'm going to have you say this one with me. This has been my theme for the last part of the year, and this is going to be my theme for 2015. This is my New Year's resolution, and I hope it can be yours too, that we're going to do faith on purpose with purpose. So I want you to say that part out loud with me. On purpose. With purpose. All right, so that's what we're going to do in 2015. That's going to be our New Year's resolution. As much as I don't like New Year's resolutions, we're going to make one as a church, to be on purpose and with purpose, and we're going to start that through these five practices. So I want you to commit to being here, and I also want you to commit to listening and thinking and contemplating with an open heart and an open mind, ready to understand what God could be using in your life. There is no Christian on earth, no matter how wonderful, who has made it, who has gotten to the point where they are as Christian as they can be. Each one of us can stand to grow a little. Each one of us can stand to be a little closer to God. And that's the call that I hope we understand, and that's what I hope we take seriously over these next several weeks. God has been using this church for over 100 years. I believe since the first congregation met here, God used them every single day, and God used us every single day. What's exciting is how God's going to use us in the future, even more and even greater than ever before. But I also believe we can serve God better than we ever have before, especially when we do it on purpose and with purpose. Amen.